Hello and welcome to the Max Moo podcast. This is Lindsay Behrens, the founder of Max Moo, a website, newsletter, and podcast about theater beyond Broadway in New York City. This is part one of a two-part episode about a relative of the theater, live comedy performance. We would love to hear what you think about this topic. Do you want to hear more about it? Let us know on Twitter, at Max Moo, M-A-X-A-M-O-O. Also, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Enjoy the show.
It would be helpful if we had a visual element for this podcast, for me mostly, because when you say Mike Lawrence, my brain is going...
Who's that?
Ding! Okay, I know who you're talking about. And then, like, a delayed laughter, like, 30 seconds later. That's a really funny thing to say about that comedian. I'm just going to ask a lot of questions and learn a lot myself.
Well, there you go. That's what this is all about.
That's my plan.
About teaching. It's a teaching opportunity.
A teaching and a learning opportunity. Good. I'll take notes so that I make sure that everything you smart people say is reflected on the website so people can just go there and there will be lots of links and clicks and stuff.
Yeah.
Comedy podcast, taking a note. This is what it sounds like to take a note. let's start with introductions. Oh, did I tell you to prepare an introduction?
Nope. I'll wing it. It's fine.
We do short introductions. Nicole will demonstrate. Nicole?
This is Nicole. I write about theater for Mildly Bitter's Musings and The Craptacular.
And I'm Lindsay, the founder of Max Moo, a website that makes theater recommendations beyond Broadway in New York City. And we have a special guest, an actual knowledgeable professional on this topic.
An actual journalist here to teach us things about things.
Elise, who are you?
I'm Elise. I write about comedy. I do the listings in the New York Times, and I write for a few other places whenever anybody wants to write about comedy, which is not as often as I would like, but I'm working on it.
Welcome. We are so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so on this podcast, we're going to talk about comedy, and I'm just going to turn it over to you, Nicole.
All the pressure's on me. I know, I cooked this thing up sort of out of thin air because we do talk about theater all the time, and I think because of the theater I've seen and some of the performers who have crossed over between sort of theater and comedy, I've been sort of curious about kind of taking our conversation about theater into this other space, which can be very intimidating, and much like theater, there are so many choices and so much out there, and nobody sort of knows where to begin. So I thought it would be fun to bring Elise here to talk with us about comedy and talk about some of the shows we've seen lately, some things that are up and coming. And then it's just an excuse for me to talk about British comedians that I like that I have no other opportunity to talk about. So. but I guess, Elise, we definitely wanted to start with maybe a little bit of the comedy landscape for people who don't know anything and feel intimidated and maybe look at the Times listings and are like, okay, you're recommending some stuff to me here. What exactly do you mean when you're sort of looking at what's happening today in comedy?
Okay. I mean, there's a lot. We talked a little bit about, you and I talked a little bit about, like, sort of the different forms of comedy, which I think is always a good place to start because I think people hear comedy and a lot of people think stand-up, which in New York is still the biggest kind of live comedy you're going to see. Lots of clubs, lots of independent shows at bars and stuff like that. And then you have sketch and improv, which is going to come out a lot of like a UCB, Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and other smaller theaters like that. And then storytelling, which is kind of the cousin of comedy that's starting to come into its own with The Moth and more storytelling shows around town. So from a form perspective, those are kind of the four major ways that you're going to see live comedy in New York. And then traditionally there was club comedy, which is in New York is Caroline's, the Comedy Cellar, Gotham Comedy Club. The kind of places you think about comedians in the 80s, like in front of brick walls, like with the button-up shirt talking about their mother-in-laws. Like that's like club, traditional club comedy. And then alternative comedy, which was like Janine Garofalo's Baby in the 90s, which is like people with notebooks and like t-shirts talking about whatever's going on in their life and like a little more unwieldy. And that's like the alternative scene. And those labels are starting to dissolve and mean less and less as people mix and as more comedy goes on the internet, podcasting like this and web series and stuff, everyone's kind of merging together. But those are the sort of basic terms that you're working with in comedy. I think like theater, like I don't know a lot about theater and you just have to try it, go see something And if you like it, then you have a lead. And if you hate it, just swerve 180 degrees and try something else. And hopefully eventually you'll find something that you can sort of grab onto.
Right. And I think the nice thing about comedy, maybe, you know, sort of different from theater, is you do have the opportunity on YouTube. Like, I've seen a lot of comedians posting bits from some of their shows, you know, sort of approved clips of them on the road doing different jokes. So you can actually really try somebody out before you go and spend the money. Although I think one of the nice things about comedy in New York is it can be actually really, really affordable. I mean, I know Elise and I have gone to the Whiplash show on Monday nights at 11 o'clock at UCB. UCB Chelsea, which is free. It's a free show at 11 o'clock Monday nights, you know, for essentially students and the unemployed. And but the lineups are usually incredible, except for that one time we went and I hated everyone.
You saw Josh Rabinowitz. Josh Rabinowitz.
I did, actually.
Good.
I really did like Josh Rabinowitz.
There's almost always a redeeming quality. I very rarely go to a stand-up show that I love everyone, and I very rarely go to one that I hate everyone. There's some that are better than others, but there's normally somebody who's got at least a few good jokes that to redeem it a bit.
And it seems like there's this type of show, and I don't. Maybe this is common or not, I don't know, where like somebody hosts it every, you know, regular weeknight on a Monday night or a Thursday night. And basically they just invite like their friends who are also stand-ups and they do really short sets. Is that a recent thing or is that always the way all the comedy has worked?
Well, there's sort of in clubs, like if you go to the Comedy Cellar, they would refer to that as a showcase show. And you would have an MC who would come up and start the show. And then you'd have anywhere between 4 to 6, 7 comics do 10 to 20 minutes. And the idea is that it's a way to try out new material and it's a way to sort of prolong a show because doing an hour takes a lot. But if you've got a newer comic, it's a way to sort of come up. And the shows that are – and that's – so that's got a separate booker. There's a booker at that club who's booking those people, which means a lot of times you do get a lot more diversity. You know, no, there's going to be someone you don't like and somebody you do, and that's what they're thinking. The bar shows, which is like a younger comic who is just inviting their friends – to do 10 or 15 minutes in the back of the basement of a pub or, you know, wherever. That's sort of the alternative thing from the 90s of just come in with your notebook, whatever you thought of on the train on the way here, talk about it, see what happens. Sometimes it's amazing. Sometimes you get lightning in a bottle. Sometimes it's a little tedious. It's sort of you're committing to just going with what they think. And if you like the host, you trust their judgment on their friends. And certain shows have better reputations than others, even though the lineups change every week. There's great shows that even if you can go to and there's going to be something reliable. And those tend to do well and other shows tend to fade away and naturally, I suppose.
Comedy feels like more of an adventure than theater does. Like, you just don't know what you're going to get when you show up. It could be great. It could be bad. It's usually a little of both. And you're just kind of game for the ride along as opposed to theater where I don't know why, but I think the expectation of every person walking into a theater is like, I better like this.
It's true. I think you have to be a little bit more flexible with comedy. I'm sure the alcohol helps, you know.
It's true.
You were talking a little bit about the cost of comedy being less than, which I appreciate that. But there are some shows where you go and there's like a, you pay to get in and then there's a drink minimum and that always feels very intimidating and somehow like, I don't know, you're getting screwed or something.
you are basically is the moral of that story. Those are those clubs. Those are the Cellar. The Cellar's actually not terrible. Gotham, Caroline's, like you can pay $45-$50 a ticket to go to Caroline's on a Saturday. And then you're paying a 2-drink minimum. I mean, no one's getting out of that room for less than $75. So you're not getting good food. You're not getting good drinks. That's sort of the older model of comedy. And newer clubs like The Stand, which in Gramercy has a $15 cover for every show, no drink minimum, but really good food, really good booze. You end up choosing to spend the money because they've put some time into it, but you can get in and out for $15 if that's all you want to spend. And then the bar shows are free or they're $5, $8, $10 at Littlefield and Bell House and places like that. Yeah. So that
tends to be... I mean, the quality of the comedy at some of those places is just fantastic. So I don't... I mean, I think I would be shocked to spend $50 on a night of comedy as a ticket. I mean, unless... I mean, you know, I noticed that... like one of the things I was thinking of an upcoming show is like Eddie Izzard is doing the Beacon Theater, mm-hmm. where I'm sure the tickets are, you know, much more expensive than you would anticipate for, you know, comparable to theater.
Right. Right. All right. Well, let's talk about some, Elise always goes to see a lot of comedy. Nicole sees a little bit of comedy. I see hardly none at all, but in the past couple of weeks have endeavored to see more comedy. So let's...
Kicking and screaming against her will.
That's not true. That's not true. I like to have fun. I just don't like it when they try to talk to you.
Hey, you didn't get twerked on this week. I got twerked on.
Nicole got twerked on.
Who did you get twerked on by?
Louisa Omilan.
Oh, were you in the front row?
Like we're like continuing her joke of fucking up her last name.
Were you guys in the front for that?
No. Nicole's on the aisle, though. Oh,
that will happen.
And so she came down the aisle, and there was a lot of butt action happening.
Yes, perfect segue. So this is a show we all saw. Yeah.
Which I knew would be divisive. I suggested it. I put it in my Times listings, but I knew it was the kind of show that a lot of people weren't going to like, but I have a soft spot for.
For her.
For so her, for the show.
Okay, so why don't you give us just like a very brief description?
Okay. Louisa Omilan is a British stand-up, and she's doing a show now called What Would Beyoncé Do?, which is sort of a halfway between stand-up and one-woman theater storytelling kind of show that traces, I forget where it starts. It starts with a breakup and
doesn't everything these days
or it has a break it's about
there's
sort
definitely
of,
a breakup
there's
involved.
Definitely a breakup it starts it's sort of a year of her life where things start to go out of control and she decides that she and Beyonce are the same age, so she's going to start looking to Beyonce for all of the clues about what she should do to improve her life, and so she divides her story up into different sections sort of linked to different Beyonce songs. So Independent Woman, when she's talking about moving back home with her mother. And I've sort of forgotten all the other ones.
You're looking at the wrong people for additional information.
This is the funniest thing about this. I realized that, like, I know nothing about Beyonce.
I know slightly more than Nicole knows, but I'm still very unhelpful.
I mean, it was nice to see, like, there was a lot of women in the audience for this show. Yeah. There were a lot of women who were clearly Beyonce fans who were, like, dancing along and singing along. And actually, she called some women up on stage to sing along to Single Ladies. Mm. And the women did the entire dance routine with her. And they were just audience people. They were not plants.
Yeah.
So.
And it was clear she had been, like, you're going to know what's going on here. You come up on stage.
She had profiled these people. Yeah. She's no fool. She's a professional.
Now, I was really excited to talk to you about this because about midway through the show that Nicole and I attended together, you attended a same show, different night.
Right.
The show seemed to kind of break down a little bit, and she did a whole, like, I'm really popular in my home country and you New Yorkers, like all, she kept saying like all 11 of you in the room, even though there were slightly more of us, you could tell it was like not
a little
like,
anemic.
Not the size of the crowd she was used to performing in front of, because she's very popular back in the UK. Right. And it seemed like it come off as a moment, like not necessarily unplanned, like not totally improvised. But there did really genuinely seem to be a breakdown of the show happening at that moment. So I was very curious to know if that same exact thing happened on the night you attended, or if that was...
I think it came later in the show when I saw it. She sort of made reference to it at the end. And actually, she did a show here in, I want to say, September on the Upper West Side in a tiny little theater that really did genuinely have 11 people in it. And she made reference to it then. I think part of the reason she does that when she's doing it in front of a small crowd is that it's a very high energy show. The music comes in every few minutes. She is working her ass off. Like, even if you didn't like it, you'd have to give her credit for how hard she works. And it doesn't always translate if you don't have enough people to sort of to feed that energy back to her. And I think that's her way of saying, like, I might seem a little crazy being this high energy in a room that doesn't inherently have that energy. So you have to understand this is a show meant to be done in front of 200 people or 500 people and not 30 people, which is, I think I would love to see her sort of turn the show down a little bit to match the energy in the room rather than keeping it where it is in the front of a big crowd and then diving down and being like, look, I know this is too big for this room, but it is what I have. And then sort of jumping back into the show. I would love to, for her to sort of fine tune it and read the room and find a way to really bring people in. But it's just not, I don't know if that's her style.
It's weird because the show had a very sort of Jekyll and Hyde quality, because at some point in her, I mean, you know, there's this high energy Beyonce dancing, my life's like Beyonce, except clearly it's not, and my life is a complete mess. And I mean, you know, and that's the joke. And then it escalates to this really poignant personal family story that she's telling in the middle of it that has not a comedic release, and you know, like barely a comedic release anywhere in there. And in some ways for me, like, that was suddenly the most successful part of the show, and everything else that had sort of come before and even that came afterwards felt like it didn't all sort of come together, like that flow. And I would expect it. I mean, and it's a 90-minute show, and I think if you're seeing somebody do a 90-minute show, it is likely going to have sort of an overarching theme and connection, and or you hope things that sort of came up in the beginning come back in the end. And so even if you've seen them do the stand-up and they've done bits and pieces of this, when it gets woven together into a 90-minute show, it does have a cohesion feeling. And I felt like sort of coming out of that show, like, it felt a little Frankenstein, like things got sort of pasted on together and it didn't actually flow as well between the segments. But I don't know if anyone else felt that way.
Well, that's what I think, what made me think that the breakdown was genuine and that things just didn't seem to be going as exactly as planned. But anyway, this show is at Subculture, which is at a new venue on Bleecker Street. It's been open about 5 months. It's extremely clean. It has a very nice bar, excellent bathrooms. As a comedy-phobish kind of person, I would say this is a great place to, like, dip your toe into the comedy waters. In terms of, like, I don't want to go somewhere that's scary and dank and damp. Mm-hmm. This place felt very comfortable, very modern, excellent, like good lights and sound and all that stuff.
Everything feels new and shiny. You definitely go to some places where I'm like, I'm going to get bed bugs just by sitting here.
Yes, I have been in theaters where mice were running around the seats.
Oh my God.
not a comedy show, just a regular theater show where I have to lift my bag up off the floor and put it on my lap.
You don't want to take a mouse home with you.
For reference, Subculture is used a lot for classical music. I think that was one of their primary things for the first few months they were open, and they've really, in the last couple months, really started to invest in comedy. But yeah, they do a lot of classical music there. So it's that sort of slightly more highbrow than most comedy, which is part of the reason we saw three shows there within the course of like 2 weeks. And it feels like a very nice sort of meeting ground between theater and comedy, which is sort of was my thinking in suggesting some of those shows, that somebody likes theater. Yeah, like you said, it's a good entryway into comedy.
Yeah. So do we all also see Rory Scovel there? Mm-hmm. We saw it together. Yep. You saw it also, right?
Yes.
Okay, I can't. It's all blurring together. Okay. So, someone describe Rory Scovel.
I'll do my best, because he's one of my favorite stand-ups who's working in anywhere in the States right now. His stuff is very... He's a stand-up comedian. His material is very... a little bit absurdist, very improvised. I've seen him do an hour, maybe. This was my third time seeing him do a full hour with some of the same jokes, but just totally different transitions, totally... very interactive with the crowd, kind of very good at reading a room in the sort of the way that Louisa wasn't quite. He's exceptional at plays a lot with accents, plays a lot with different very subtle characters. That he released an album a few months ago where he did the first bit in a very exaggerated Southern accent without reference, and then eventually just was like, anyways, that was that character that I did. If you didn't know who he was, you would have... I've seen him do an entire hour with a very slight German accent. No, 50 minutes in, he makes one reference to it, and that's it. What are you doing? That's awesome. So he's incredible. I think he's incredible. He just recorded his first special, so that should be out soon for people that want to track it.
Where's the special going to air?
I should have looked that up. I don't actually know. He recorded it in South Carolina, I think, over the weekend.
He's on a TV show on, I want to say TBS, maybe? Yes.
Ground Floor.
Thank you. I wasn't going to be able to... That was a good pull. I wasn't going to be able to pull that out of my brain. I really loved his show. I thought he was so funny. I thought it was great.
Yeah, and I think you bring up an interesting point, like when you see certain comedians over and over again, and I think that's one of the fun things. Like, if you're going around to New York clubs and you're seeing different people in different lineups, you're like, oh, wait, I just saw this person last week. Oh, no. different comics, like there are some people who are working out different material at different times and seeing them multiple times. I have certainly come to appreciate different comics doing some of the same bits over and over again to see how they play, to see how they, you know, move through them and to see sort of what they add and what they take away. And others where I'm like, nope, I've seen your 10 minutes. I don't like it. I've seen it again. Still don't like it. Good to know, Ali Wong. but no, I did enjoy Rory, and I thought he did some sort of like some political stuff, and you know, the audience sort of wasn't quite sure, and so he sort of called people on it, and I think that worked. You did a woot, and
I wooted. I wooed. He called out my hometown, and I spontaneously wooed without like even being able to stop myself. But as soon as that happened, my brain was like, shut. And then he asked a follow-up question, and there was just silence in the audience.
Like, that person from Salt Lake City has now died, so they can't respond to my question.
It was extremely awkward. But there was the jaws of life would not have pried a sound from my mouth at that moment. It's amazing I was still sitting in my chair and not under the bench.
She had just spontaneously combusted. I almost felt so guilty. I was like, I'll answer the question. I'm not from Salt Lake City and I didn't woot, but I mean, you know.
I don't know.
So, Rory, if you're listening, sorry.
This actually all dates back. This is a stupid story that no one's going to think is funny except for me. But this all dates back to the summer when Nicole and I were in Edinburgh. And we saw quite a bit of stand-up there, actually. And one night we went to a show where, I don't know, it's like random they invite random comedians and they say
set list.
They say a word or something, and then they have to do
prompts, and they have to
get their set list. The comedians come in, and they're not allowed to use any of their own material, and they have to get the prompts from like a random list. And it's just, I mean, you know, this it'd be like cheese and go do some bit about cheese.
Yeah, so I guess it's all improvised, but not sketch improvisation, stand up improvised. And the night we went, they happened to be filming it for the Nerdist, and the host was like, "Everybody say we love you, Chris Hardwick." And in my brain, I was thinking, "I love you, Jonah Ray," and everyone shouts, "I love you, Chris Hardwick," and I wanted to shout, "Jonah Ray," but I didn't. It would have been so funny.
It would have been pretty funny.
But that was an interesting show, just talking about how watching comedians work. Like, that was a show that allowed you to see comedians, when stripped of their own material, what their delivery is and how strong their delivery is, regardless of the material. And there were people who thrived. There were people who were just could make any word funny just because they have that kind of control and could read the audience. And then there was one guy who was just dying.
Oh,
I mean,
so
he
painful.
Was dying. He got like the word was like gemstone or something, and he couldn't even think of a single gemstone. He's like, anyone a gemstone? And someone's like, sapphire.
He's like, thank you.
Yeah, the funniest laugh he got was when he was like, thank you. I mean, and you felt for this guy who's clearly like an up and coming comic who is doing his work, but like, just it was
as
painful.
Somebody who has a fairly empathetic. That I don't know what my pronunciation was on that word. Empathetic way, like someone dying on stage like that. Like, I just feel so much vicarious shame that it's incredibly painful.
I'm sorry, my laughter can't lift you up, sir.
Exactly. But I mentioned the Nerdist, so I do want to say one great way to learn about comedy is podcasts, and the Nerdist podcast and WTF, and there are a billion other ones that are going to go unnamed and offend our number one fan that I'm not referencing her favorites. But anyway, that's a great way to learn about comedy, because they do these interviews, and not just about like who are comedians, but I don't know, I've kind of find the whole like background of comedy and what a comedian's life is like, and the like being on the road and being a road warrior is sort of fascinating. So anyway, plug for those kinds of things.
If you're looking for, the behind the scenes.
But I want to talk about the third show we saw at Celeb Culture, because it was a little bit different than the other shows.
Yes.
So we saw The Pajama Men.
Right. And you and I saw that together, and you saw that.
I didn't see
that. You didn't see it at all. Okay.
No.
Well, The Pajama Men are a sketch duo who've been around for a really long time. They're American, but they are very, very popular. Like Louisa, very popular in the UK, very popular in Australia. They play Edinburgh every year, like sell out everywhere.
to like a 1,000-seat house, like the biggest venue that in Edinburgh.
Let's also say, though, that the UK also loves Darren Brown. Like, they have this really weird obsession with magicians. So we can't always use them as like high cultural touchstone.
No, I wouldn't.
And I didn't like the pajama men. So I'm going to, I'll put that stake in the ground right now. I've seen them twice. Once in Edinburgh, once here. Don't get it.
See, that's very interesting. I'd never seen them before. But so it's two men there. They wear pajamas, which is sort of irrelevant other than the fact that they don't have any props with them really on stage. They just have two chairs, which is when you do improv, that's generally all you have on stage is chairs. So I don't know much about them, but I'm assuming they came up somewhat at improv. They do. It's a fairly written show, although I did go back and see them again after you and I saw them, just because I wanted to see how much was improvised. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't as much as I thought, but it was still some. There were still bits where they can play. They have sort of built-in spots where they can just sort of riff and do whatever they want and know that they'll get back to the point they need to be to tell the story. And they do tell a very complicated, bizarre story about a king who becomes immortal to fight a dragon, and all these people over the course of 700 years who get involved with this quest to kill this dragon. It doesn't...
That's for adults.
Well, that is exactly the thing, actually, because were it not so complicated, it felt like a kid's show. And again, I've seen them twice, and I thought that both times.
Hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of adult humor, and, you know, there's a lot of sex and vulgarity. And so it's clearly adult, and it's so complicated. I mean, this story is so multi-pronged, and it weaves together through time and space. So it's clearly adult. But to me, it does feel like a kid's show. I don't know.
No, I think it definitely has that quality to it. And I imagine, actually, one of the things I thought seeing it, because it was at 7:30 at Subculture, which is probably not the best time for it. If you saw it, I think, at 11 o'clock at night, the silliness of it would hit you at a better place than at 7:30 in the evening when you're kind of still in a cerebral place and you want something that's going to really engage you. That's just, comedy is, it's very
comedy
different at 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock and midnight. And that's why part of the reason Whiplash is so fun is because it's 1 o'clock in the morning when you leave every single time. You're in a headspace that allows you to like things that you wouldn't necessarily like at 8 o'clock. It doesn't take away from, I'm not dismissing your ideas. I just think that is a part of what always felt a little awkward. Both times I saw them at Subculture, it was just like, this is too early for this show.
Right. That's interesting.
No, it's true, because like when Daniel Kitson came this past summer to do his stand-up show, his sit-down stand-up show, because he was sitting the entire time, it was at 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Was it 10 o'clock? It was something crazy. It was late.
Are you talking about the one over at...
Yeah, Farrell? After the beginning, before the end.
Oh, okay.
It was at 10 o'clock, right? Am I crazy?
I don't think it was that late.
Was it 9? It was later than it had been in the UK. Like, I saw it in the UK at, like, 7:30 and 8. And it was later here, because they had to do buyer and seller beforehand. So maybe it was 9:30.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
So buyer and seller was at 7:30, maybe, and then he went on 9:30,
something like that.
Or maybe 10. I swear it was 10 o'clock.
I think you're right. I think you're right. Yeah, don't talk coming back to me now.
And I realized, like, he does very complicated story shows, and it's too late at night for people to put together all of the strands when his intent is not silliness, when there's not supposed to be kind of a looseness to it. It's actually quite tight, and you really should be following sort of everything that's happening.
But I like the idea that, like, a show that's good at 7 in the UK is good at 10 in New York.
We can handle
it. That's just
later
how we are here. We roll very late at night. All right, we mentioned Night Train briefly, so
we did.
I'm
happy to talk about it.
Yeah, why don't you give more details on that, Nicole?
So this is a Monday night show, every Monday night at 8 o'clock at Littlefield in Brooklyn, and usually Wyatt Cenac is the host. And we happened to stop by during a week when he was off, sort of semi-intentionally, because I happen to be really excited about the guest hosts were the Kondabolu brothers. So Hari Kondabolu is sort of a well-known stand-up comic who has been touring around quite a bit. He's been on the John Oliver specials on Comedy Central. I think maybe the first place I saw him was Find the Funny, which is another show that we all went to at Joe's Pub, another comedy show that happens from time to time. And so he kind of got on my radar, and now I'm like obsessed, and I follow him on Twitter. And he went and did the Totally Biased TV show on FX that then moved to FXX and then died, which is very sad because I started watching it specifically for him and then found I really liked like all of the comics that were on that show. So I highly recommend people sort of check out anyone who was on that show, including W. Kamau Bell, who is the host. And so Hari and his brother, Ashok, hosted for Night Train this past week with a massive lineup of comics, which I'm sure we could talk about.
I honestly think it might be the best single comedy show I've been to. Like, I just felt like almost everyone was so strong.
That's good. Yeah.
That's all I have to say about that. It was like a collection of people. I had seen the host before. Other than that, oh no, I guess there are a couple of people I'd seen before. But for the most part, it was totally new people, and I was like, almost everyone here is funny.
Yeah, no, I think we'd seen Phoebe Robinson before.
Yep.
Mike Birbiglia showed up as sort of to do an unannounced guest spot. And I hate him.
I need to talk to you about that because it's so baffling to me.
I'm a mystery. I'm an enigma. I don't know. I really
fight. That's a wrap on part one. We hope you will join us for part two. We released both parts on the same day, so there's no delay in getting to hear the whole episode. Please also reach out to us on Twitter and let us know what you think about our comedy episode. You can find Maxmoo at Maxmoo, MaxMoo. Nicole is at Mildly Bitter, that's MILDLYBITTER. Elise is at Elise CZ, ElisecZ. And I'm at Lindsay Behrens, LindsayBarenz.